Hello and welcome to Kinnikuman's episode 439. I'm your host, Space Dad, Mike Apps, aka Wheels, and with me as always,
professional Resident Evil Zero hater, David McCurney, Phantom Master.
And back for possibly limited time, your man in Japan, Michael Baker, Gajimino Guitar.
And this is Smokin' Joe Gamer, with no clever quip.
Oh. Unadorned.
Joey Jojo.
Joey Jojo Jr. Shabadoo.
If we must.
I would never. Begin.
Things. Capcom things.
Oh, what happened to Capcom?
Oh, there's a good
thing. Brickmata's good. Resident Evil Zero is apparently trash.
Oh, it's terrible.
I've never played. I've never had that pleasure.
That's not what pleasure is, man. It's not an RPG, so I'll be quick, but its fundamental gameplay conceit doesn't work. The actual underlying, like, if you care for some reason about Resident Evil's narrative, this prequel only makes it worse. The art design is quite dull. The monsters are just someone opening up an encyclopedia and saying, what if that was a zombie, to everything that upset them? Yeah, it's just very, very tedious. Very, very bad game. Also, somehow the hunters can one-hit kill you from full health. That's a new one. I figured that one out today while I was replaying it in Wesker mode.
Jeez.
That's bad.
The HD remake is... gave it a bonus mode that gives it at least some amusement, because you can play as RE5 Wesker, and he is just... he can explode things with laser eyes for some reason. But, yeah, I attempted to explode a hunter with laser eyes, not the enemy to use that on, it killed me from full, so that was very strange. But yeah, just kind of a bad game. As I put it while I was, like, quipping at it to someone on Discord, the villain and our two protagonists feel, during their final confrontation, feel like they are talking to each other from across two different drafts of the script. Like, genuinely a perplexing final confrontation. It's beautiful because, like, the thing the villain actually wants to accomplish is to kill Albert Wesker and William Birkin from Resident Evil 1 and 2. Obviously, you can't do that because then Resident Evil 1 and 2 wouldn't happen. But they leave the story halfway through and just disappear. And then at the end, he starts yelling about how he's going, like, he starts yelling about bringing down the world in Hellfire, but also it wouldn't have mattered if our protagonists were here or not, because as it turns out, his plan is foiled by the fact that exposure to the sun kills him.
Yes. It's a weird game.
It's very bad. There is a point where it turns out that the villain is a leech that ate the DNA of an old guy who used to work for Umbrella.
Yep.
And then while imitating him, like, goes from a young man version of him that sings a lot to control leeches into an old man version of him that for some reason has a different accent.
It's
a very perplexing game, and it's very, very bad.
So the T-virus was actually spread by some goth dude who does opera singing, and then you find out, oh no, he controls the leeches with his voice, and it's like, no, wait, he actually is a leech man himself. Yeah.
So. Yeah, it's very stupid, and I will say, like, just as when I say, like, the plot makes Resident Evil worse, I bring that up because, like, Resident Evil 1, there isn't an explanation for the inciting incident that caused all the fucking like T-Virus to spread in the mansion, because it was, it doesn't need one. It's just something that was bound to happen.
Right.
Like, given what they were doing, yeah, of course that happened. Resident Evil Zero is like, ah, yes, I sent the leeches out to spread the virus in the mansion. And it's like, that only makes the game worse. Yeah. Very bad. Ugh. Not recommend. yeah, I'm continuing my blast through all the classic Resident Evils. So, 3 in Code Veronica are what's left. I'm halfway through playthroughs of both.
I'm so happy that Resident Evil Origins Collection on Switch has only Resident Evil Zero on the cartridge. Huh?
That is like the saddest thing I've ever heard.
And then I want to say we don't see Rebecca again until one of the movies. I think it was Vendetta, the CG movie.
Well, obviously she's also in RE1, but yes.
Right. That's true.
Also, it's impossible to square away what she's doing in RE1 with what happens in RE0. She seems to have just thrown a whole bunch of weapons away and had some sort of traumatic head injury.
yeah.
Just a baffling video game. The only funny thing...
Chris, does this mean that the Resident Evil movie actually has a better reasoning behind it than this game does?
Probably not.
Depends on which one. There's like 5 Resident Evil
movies. I'm talking about the first of the Resident Evil movies.
With Mila Jovovich. Yeah.
I don't think I have seen that in 10 years, so I don't know.
That one, I think it was pretty basic in that one, wasn't it? There was a vial with T-Virus and somebody dropped it and it got into the air filtration system. And then
it did have a better reasoning.
Right, and then the security computer detected it and put the whole place into lockdown. But then you find out that there was this guy trying to steal the virus to sell on the black market and he doesn't quite make it out. Yeah.
That man's name was Albert Wesker. But yeah, no, like I would describe that as better, although I don't buy the notion of T-Virus as airborne. But that's a deep nerd thing.
Well, then, didn't RE2 try to say that rats carried it into the city?
Yes, RE2 very explicitly says that rats carried it into the city. It's like rats in the sewer water.
Okay.
Because the inciting incident that causes that is also very obvious. Because we see like William Birkin get shot and then a whole bunch of vials break, and also he injects himself with a G-virus, which is why he's skulking around. But yeah. But caring about Resident Evil canon is like the least useful thing someone can do with their time, so we will move on from that.
But it's fun.
Fun, fun, fun.
As long as you don't take it too seriously.
Oh, yeah, no, it's fun, which is why I care about it at all. But like, you know, like the easiest thing to do is to just pretend Resident Evil Zero didn't happen because it adds nothing and it's never referenced again. Right. Funniest thing it also does is that it drags the original Gun Survivor kicking and screaming into canon for no reason other than mentions it during its opening prologue.
Yeah.
In case you remember what Sheena Island is.
No, I don't.
It's the setting of Resident Evil Gun Survivor.
I didn't play that one. Yeah.
It's bad. It's very, very bad.
I was playing... what was I playing? I was playing the Umbrella Chronicles on PS3, which is, hey, what if Resident Evil was House of the Dead? And it actually kind of works, and... Yeah. So I thought that would be quicker than trying to actually play Resident Evil Zero, and it is. Yeah, so it gets... Billy shows up immediately, and then it skips the giant centipede boss and goes right to the giant bat. And that... So those are just... So 2 stages, you're already halfway through the game. It's like, okay. And it's like, oh yeah, this doesn't make any sense. And then I was going to say, I was browsing through YouTube, and I saw an interesting video title about Resident Evil Requiem, and I watched it, and it turns out it explains how to get that weird achievement where you have to, like, it's like when you're in the processing facility, you have to Yeah,
the final puzzle.
Right. So when you're in the processing facility in the basement, you have to just sit there for like 20 minutes letting bodies get fed into the grinder. And then when you're done with that part, the doll will show up or something. And I don't know. It's weird. But
there's a few other things you have to do. But yeah, that's the long and short of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because then that causes more blood in the next. Yeah, right. The doll shows up in like a future area. But then you have to. Then in your next playthrough, there's other stuff you have to do. You have to look at the doll at certain points and inspect it. And then you have to bring...
You don't have to inspect the doll. You just have to bring it with you during a specific point and fail to solve a puzzle properly 3 times. But... Yeah.
Right. So it's... I was like, well, that's weird. And that's something you wouldn't even be able to figure out unless you watched a YouTube video like I did.
It was meant to be like something that the community would come together to solve, like an ARG.
Yeah.
I thought it was neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So none of these are RPGs. Did anyone play an RPG?
Sort of.
That I'm willing to admit to?
Okay. Damn.
Wow. Okay, so right now in the Switch, I have a game called Entogakuen Quest, Class of Heroes Quest.
Oh, no.
Which in hindsight, the fact that I was able to buy it new at a retail store at 90% off market price.
That's not a good sign. It's
not a good sign.
Listen, I have another thing that was
a year and a half after it was released.
I have another sign that it was a bad sign. It's that it was called Classic Heroes.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, it's this weird sort of real-time tactical.
Oh, that game. Oh, no.
Yeah, not strategy, tactical.
Oh, I think I know what game that is.
Yeah. I mean, if it was Class of Heroes, it probably is. And unfortunately, it also has some major difficulty spikes on certain stages. So that, like, one stage, as soon as these two monster generators are activated, they will basically Zerg rush you if you do not take them out immediately. That kind of thing. And I'm currently stuck on one stage where it does something similar to me, and I can't actually destroy the generators on that stage because it's a survival. I have to survive 3 minutes in that stage, and I can't get it past 2. So, yeah, it's unfortunately grindy, unbalanced difficulty, and I am curious to see if I can actually get more money back on the resale than I paid for it in the first place. But yeah. That's what I'm trying to work through right now, so it's been fun.
Yeah, I got back into Final Fantasy 14 and I'm currently doing Shadowbringers content. And it's really neat. You get transported to this other dimension or something, and just some really gorgeous environments to explore, and you're trying to stop these light monsters from killing everyone. Yeah, and it's like you find out that the world that you've been exploring this whole time is the source, and then there's all these other worlds, and if one of the elements gets too strong, it can just kind of destroy it and then cause catastrophe in the source world. And somebody last night, you guys were just telling me, oh, that sounds like Final Fantasy 6 or something like that.
No, Final Fantasy
3. Yeah. 3. Oh, see, of course I mix up 3 and 6 all the time. We all do.
Not me.
Yeah. So this is a world where the light element got way too strong and a bunch of people died, and it created these weird monsters called Sin Eaters. And so I just did the first dungeon of that area, and now the main city actually has night again, because it used to be light all the time, and now they actually have a day-night cycle again, and they're happy about it. But we're still no closer to understanding or preventing the predicted tragedy that might befall the main source area. The Empire is still developing some kind of deadly gas that kills people. So, it's interesting.
Yeah. Is it deadly?
So, you know, I like to play the bard, the ninja, summoner. Sometimes I switch to scholar. So I like the whole job system. I like the combat. I like so many things about it. And the irony is I just don't care for the social aspects of it at all.
Now, they've more and more catered the game to people like that, so I think you'll be fine.
Yeah, so now it lets me do some of the main story dungeons with computer allies who aren't completely incompetent, and it's like, oh, this is great. Cool. So, and of course, they just announced another expansion coming out in January called Evercold. So I guess that takes place in another alternate timeline world where there's too much cold, there's too much snow, I don't know, but... hopefully I'll get caught up on everything before that comes out. I don't know. We'll see what happens. And they've been tinkering with the PS3, and so today I was playing Hot Shots Golf Out of Bounds, which is, I guess, a golf RPG, you could argue. And
I did not play that one, so I don't know.
Yeah, that one was a PS3 exclusive that never got ported or remastered or anything. But it's good. And the thing is, you can play it on Plus Premium, but it's cloud streaming, so you'll have input lag and frame rate drops, and good luck hitting the ball on, you know, getting the timing right when you hit the ball.
Yeah, I can't think of a like, it's like that in rhythm games, where it's like, there is nothing that can be more immediately defeated by the kind of stream lag that that produces.
Yep. And I had tried playing it on the RPC3 emulator, RCPS3, whatever it is.
RCPS3.
Yeah. So while it does work on that emulator, it actually, it's the same thing. Like, the graphics don't look any better, and this frame rate seems a little choppy. So it's good to just be playing on original hardware again. And apparently my save file was still intact, so I was able to just jump right in and win an 18-hole tournament, even though I made many mistakes. So yeah, just playing a lot of PS3 games lately, and I was playing a tower defense game called Savage Moon that I always thought was neat, but never, I would say maybe it's a hidden gem. I don't know. So, yeah, and then we were playing Sonic Racing Cross Worlds last night for shenanigans, which is also not an RPG. I told you guys I got a mint condition used copy of Disgaea D2, which is still PS3 exclusive. And while that one is much easier to play through streaming and it does emulate pretty well, it's the same kind of thing. I had a post-game save file, and it's like, I don't want to start over. So what I did was I loaded up that save file, and then I talked to an NPC who's like, hey, how'd you like to go back in time? And I said, sure. And that's how you get New Game Plus. So now I can just blow through the story. I didn't lose any of my characters or XP money. I still have like 30 million gold or something. So that's neat to revisit. And beyond that, I'd like to play through the Final Fantasy 13 games again. So I'm currently playing the Xbox 360 version of 13, which was X enhanced on the Series X and all that. So that's 4K resolution, 30 FPS, but it's pretty stable. It looks gorgeous. I just always liked the combat in that game, and I thought the story was a little weak, but I do like the characters. I would say there's some excellent voice acting despite a pretty bad script. And I think Gaijin was explaining last night. Well, I think you were explaining last night that they kept revising the script while recording the voice lines.
The script, I mean, a lot of the story was not finalized while they were still working on most of the game. I mean, it was like a total, and at the same time they were going for a worldwide release, or a very short window of time between Japan and everywhere else. So usually when they're doing one of these games, they have a completed Japanese version to work off of, and they did not have that with 13.
Okay.
And even the Japanese side was having trouble with revisions and happening while recording. So it was, all sorts of fun with that one.
So I'm trying to get through that again, and then I still have my PS3 copy of 13.2, and then I think I have Lightning Returns on Steam. So I'm like, all right, well, sure, I'll play each one on a different platform. Who cares? Doesn't matter. So there's that. Who else would like to talk about what they've been playing?
I've been playing Pragmata.
Okay.
It's good.
It's very good. Concept continues to work. It's still throwing wrenches at me. I think I'm on the final boss. Which, regardless, it's a very cool fight. So, very good game. Highly recommend. Runs great on Switch 2. And honestly, I'm looking forward to... I want to beat the story and then kind of work on some extra stuff after that's done. But I want that to be done before Indie comes out. So it's kind of the next story I'm going to be playing. It's like 2 weeks.
2 weeks, Jesus. Yeah.
Been trying to finish off some Falcon games, trying to finally finish East 9, which I haven't finished because I watched on stream and saw all the story, so it was kind of hard to get motivated to do that, but I'm trying to finish that one up. And finally, Trails in the Sky, second chapter, which I've gotten very bored with the gameplay, although the story is obviously a lot is going on. It's very cool. So I use a save editor to make all my characters level 99 and give them the ultimate weapons.
I don't even know why you're here.
Yeah, and I've still been doing East 10 as part of, you know, my RP Gamer streams, and I think I'm getting very close to the end now. That game is pretty neat. Like, early on I was struggling, and then turns out I just wasn't doing adequate level grinding. You know, it's like, hey, it's a JRPG. Duh. So, It's like, why do bosses have so much health? It's like, because you're not high enough level to be fighting them. It's like, oh, yeah. It's Vikings and pirates, and you go around on your boat. And I like the ship battles. I like the exploration. You got all these different islands you can go to. And yeah, all the East games are great. Really, everybody should just play all of them. I didn't get very
memory
didn't
Calcutta
get far into 9.
For Switch comes out right now.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't get too far into 9, but I did play... I did Oath and Fulgana. I played quite a bit of 8, although I didn't finish it.
Shit, it's
really and... cool. Yeah. And then, so a long time ago, I did have, you know, East 4 on the Vita, and ended up selling it, and then ended up getting a Steam copy. So that was my question. This new release, is it a remaster or a remake or just
it's
a port?
Just a port.
Okay.
It's
a port with some tuned up options.
Yeah.
Okay. Good to know. So speaking of games that started on the Vita, looks like Fireminer does have a question that might be relevant to that.
Anyone remember a mediocre JRPG on the 3DS and Vita called Extestra?
I do not.
And I reviewed that sucker.
I figured there was like at least 50% chance that you had reviewed it.
Yeah. Not 50. I mean, if anybody reviewed it, in fact, the news article on this one's Steam release has my review linked to it.
I was more just saying that, like, the if you hadn't reviewed it, then I would have assumed no one on the site had.
Yeah.
I read
back over it, and I'm like, I'm getting flashbacks. I'm like, oh, crap. This game. Yeah. I gave it a 2. With good reason.
Wow.
Yeah, the story was mediocre. The levels kept recycling themselves. It's like, oh, it was, boy. I mean, short of very specific monsters showing up later in the game, only later in the game, it was impossible to tell from a screenshot which dungeon you might be in at any given time.
just and even then, I mean, the list of monsters never really changed. It just expanded, and so you had the same monsters from the very beginning would show up in later dungeons just with a massive health boost.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. I'm trying to remember here. All of the menus were nested in weird ways that were obviously supposed to make things more streamlined, but just made it harder to find everything. Mm-hmm. And especially since the cursor didn't really have a memory, so if you were using like a cooking menu or an equipment menu, you had to go back to square one for every single item.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that.
Yeah.
And also for battle menus. So the auto battle option was actually the best thing to use for a long time because it knew all of the equipment attack lists better than you did and could just find stuff faster. But at the same time, the game had a mechanic called Burst where if you didn't have enough mana to use an attack, you could draw against your own hit points.
Hmm.
And
I thought that could be interesting.
And the auto battle AI would almost always go for the strongest possible attacks.
Oh no.
And the physical attacks did not have a setup cost. They had a percentage cost.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, this one attack would always take 20% of your mana. Uh-huh. Regardless.
Yeah.
And the hero's biggest attack at the end, which you could not disable from the auto attack options, took 88%.
Oh, so just auto attack was worthless for that character?
No, I mean, there was no individualized auto attack. There was group auto attack.
Oh, that's even worse.
Yeah, so just a whole long list of interestingly poor decisions. And this is before we get to the thematic choice of making the primary empowerment technique kissing.
Oh, God. Okay. So I've heard enough.
Now there is a kissing minigame that could be done.
No, I'm not listening to more of this.
Empower allies.
I'm on the phone right now.
The game's setup menu had a toggle for whether or not you wanted to use it. It had a gender-specific toggle. You could turn it off for boys, you could turn it off for girls. Yes. So, yeah, if anyone was listening and thinking that they would like to try this anyway, I'm guessing this may have been actually made for you. It was not made for any of us. Yeah, this is kind of my relationship with Furyu in a nutshell. That I either really enjoy their games or really don't. And a lot seems to fall on which machine the game was designed for in the first place. And this was definitely made for Vita. It was part of their Vita team's production. This and Unchained Blades, I just, like, no. Somebody over there on the Vita side really liked dungeon RPGs and far more than was healthy. Let's just say it that way.
So to hit the question that sprang from this, so there's an HD remaster on Steam for ungodly reasons, and that's being localized.
Why?
Fireminer says more Vita ports.
Yeah, that was my reaction when Severin added me in staff channel. I'm like, why? Why? Further reaction. I don't know how a localization would improve this unless they went full on ghost stories.
yeah. To get to the meat of the question, playing more Vita ports are good news for me, but I wonder how many other times have an average or even bad game, but not a meme, so no Night Trap, gotten a remaster. It happens a lot, but it's usually when a company is like, it usually comes from companies that kind of just have a whole bunch of licenses that they don't give much of a shit about.
Yeah.
Like that's when you start getting some of these. Like I saw someone get, very confused by the recent Gmode Archives stuff on Steam, where it's just like, oh, no, those aren't what you think they are. Those are old phone games.
Ugh.
Yeah. Which, I mean, to be fair, some of them were really interesting, weird little phone games, and it's nice to actually have somebody attempting to preserve some of these things, regardless.
Yeah, no, I'm not upset that they exist, but like this person, I forget what game it was, but it had the same name as like an actual game that people would want to see come back. And like they were like, oh, that's cool. And I was like, that's not what you think it is. But yeah, like just one of those things that like, it was like Shin Megami Tensei Digital Devil Saga, but it was like the phone game.
Oh, yeah, one of those.
And they saw that, and they were like, oh, that's cool, that's coming to Steam. And I'm like, that's not the one you're thinking of. Similarly, like, the random-ass collections of old, like, mobile RPGs that find their way to consoles, I would consider that. If we're talking, like, modern ports, when Limited Run isn't doing, like, meme games, like, Plumbers Don't Wear Ties and Night Trap and Double Switch or whatever. Like their random assortments of old licensed games probably count as this too. I don't think that the Marvel Maximum Collection is a meme, but basically everything on that collection is bad.
Yep. But Maximum Carnage.
That's the best thing on that collection.
But what's the other one?
The arcade game.
No, there was what's the other Spider-Man game on there.
Arcade's Spider-Man Revenge?
Venom, Spider-Man and Venom and Separation Anxiety.
Yeah, that's the one.
But there's also Spider-Man and the X-Men and Arcade's Revenge, which might be the best thing on
Vomit.
like that game is fighting like a life or death battle to determine whether that or the NES Silver Surfer is worse. And the answer is actually Arcade's Revenge on probably like Game Boy or Game Gear. I don't know which.
Jesus Christ.
Silver Surfer on NES is horrendous, but at least has some banging music. But yeah, like it's like, I wouldn't consider that a meme, but that is a collection of almost entirely bad games. The SNK 40th anniversary collection is really nice. It's a collection of all of their like pre Neo Geo games, but it also includes the console ports. And a lot of those were made by, a lot of NES, ports from SNK were made by a company called Micronics, and Micronics was just like an infamously bad NES like Famicom contract developer, to the point where there's like rumors that it might have just been one dude. But basically infamously bad contract developer. And so you get things like Athena, which was a perplexing arcade game and a completely inscrutable Famicom game. And like that collection is full of shit like that, and it's like, well, that's kind of like, that sucks, but it owns, so you know. Or like Ikari 3 the Rescue or Street Smart, like, you know, bad games, but like really funny bad games, and you know, presented with extreme care. Like that collection is actually really good. It's just that, like, if you're including the console games especially, a lot of early SNK games are quite bad. Because, the earliest one of these games was from 1979. Of course, it's not. It doesn't hold up as we would traditionally understand it. Like, Sasuke vs. Commander is from 1980 and might be the first video game with boss fights. But, wow. You know. Like it's not what we would call traditionally good, but you know, it's fascinating and it's cool that it comes back. But a lot of times you'll see this sort of come back when like a company has bought like some wild like a giant pile of old like licenses from some like random merger or buyout, and they don't really know what to do with them, so they just sort of throw them on like modern services, emulations or whatever. And I think that can be kind of neat. Okay, let's put some more. What do you think about the Sega Universe initiative? I think they've announced this like 3 times, and it's at this point piss or get off the pot.
Yeah, I thought they'd already announced that when I saw that.
Like I said, I think they've announced that like 3 times. We know that's been on the slate for many years, but we don't know exactly much what will be done with titles other than like soccer awards. Will they make Streets of Rage 5 by themselves or give it to someone else? Or who's going to make the Run Sega Gaga sequel? I don't think everything that they mentioned is getting a sequel, although like I would suspect a fair number will. But just a moment. Yeah, like it's one of those things. Like this initiative they've announced or reannounced. Like they showed like prototypes of like a Crazy Taxi and a Jet Set Radio and a Golden Axe and a Streets of Rage, and we haven't seen shit about them since. Like, how many of those are real projects? I don't know. But yeah. Like it's funny that they keep re-announcing it. When they first announced them, I think they were talking about how they were going to be part of their Super Game initiative, a project that was officially supposed to have borne fruit by now, and I think is probably just going to eventually have its component parts used for scrap, because the idea probably was like a bunch of interconnected games that didn't make any goddamn sense. But yeah, I mean, I'd love like a remaster of like Rent-A-Hero number one, a game that has almost come out in English like 3 times. But for those who don't know what Rent-A-Hero was, the original Rent-A-Hero was a Mega Drive RPG where a guy like orders a pizza, and in addition to his pizza, he gets like a superhero suit and uses that superhero suit to do like odd jobs. Like, hey, go fucking get my cat out of that tree, go deliver some shit for me, I don't give a shit. Like, it's funny and stupid in that way. Rent-A-Hero number one was a Dreamcast remake that was later ported to the Xbox. The Xbox version almost came out in English, and by almost came out in English, I mean was so far along it was reviewed in magazines.
Oh, wow.
And then was canceled at the very last possible minute. There's a dump of that floating around, but emulating an original Xbox is a huge pain in the ass, so I don't recommend doing that. But yeah, I'd love for some version of Rent-A-Hero number one, or original Rent-A-Hero, or ideally both, to finally find its way into America, because it's a fun idea. It's a fun idea. Rent-A-Hero is stupid, but it's fun. That's kind of the point. But yeah, I'd love to see that. I asked last year about the idea that some game director can make a sequel or remake to be a completely different thing to its predecessor as a response to the original. What do you think about the phenomenon of a film director unable to get funding for their original ideas, so they take the reins of an adaptation of a game or novel and then make it completely their own thing? The Halo show and the upcoming Far Cry show seem to have some shades of this. I mean, you know, it's inevitably in the execution. I'm not terribly wedded to the idea of like direct adaptations. Have you imagined what a direct adaptation of Halo into a film show would have looked like? Like, that show's not good, but like a direct adaptation of Halo into a show wouldn't have made sense either. You gotta adapt for what the medium is suited for, and like a video game level is basically a continuous action scene, and like the pacing demands of a game are very different from like pure linear media, so you get pretty different things to go along. So yeah, I don't think that's a bad thing, especially like it helps in this case that I'm not terribly wedded to either Halo or especially Far Cry canon. But
Far Cry has canon.
It does, apparently. But bearing in mind that like most of the Far Cry games are just sort of anthology anyway, as far as I can tell. Like, you know, I'm sure they reference each other, but like most Far Cry games plots don't seem to be contingent on what occurred in the previous ones. They don't really carry characters that far.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of the coolest things in Far Cry 6 is that you find a note on a shipping container and you open it and then it's Boomer from Far Cry 5. He somehow got shipped to, you know, the wherever the 6 takes place, you know. It's like, wait, how did he go from Montana to Cuba? You know what I mean?
Yeah, in any case, like, it definitely seems to be, you know, it's primarily an anthology series anyway. It can get by with just sort of occasionally referencing that something has occurred. So I don't think it's particularly weird to, like, if you have a story that, like, fits that mold especially, you know, why not? Probably going to work better than adapting any specific game tale in that process. Let's see. Okay, so Cave shut down 2 live service games and thus suffered a loss of $6.3 million, which pushed them to resurrect Dodonpachi Resurrection. It'll work for now, but it sucks knowing that it's an uphill battle if Cave ever wants to make a new IP from now on. The story that they have to take a cash injection by issuing more shares to their biggest shareholders in order to be able to develop console games. Yeah, that tends to be what happens. Like, you give more equity to investors in order to justify them giving you more money that you use to fund a project. And Sakuna, Rise and Ruin mobile spinoff will shut down in July, so it will only run for 5 months. That seems to happen a lot. Like, you need to go big at the start, or else, like, your ambitions get curtailed, because, like, especially in that space, there's so many things launching all the time. Like, you're not going to suddenly pick numbers up, you know, a year in. Like, what you got at the start was kind of what you're going to get, unless you get some enough that you can, like, build up to bigger things. Let's see. Is there a point for a Parappa the Rapper game with actual rap lyrics? I think the PS2 has a few games about being a rapper, but I just can't recall them. There was the PS2 rap karaoke game Get on the Mic. Doesn't work too well. The game can't actually, isn't very good at determining what the actual lyrics you're saying are. If you ever played like Karaoke Revolution or Rock Band, like, those are primarily detecting pitch with only a bare attempt to figure out what you're actually saying. Well, Get on the Mic was a rap game, so not really about detecting pitch. They just weren't able to make that work. There's probably a few others. But, like, that's the one that immediately comes to mind. I think Parappa was kind of fun and refreshing just because it was, like, entirely original music. We don't see as much of that in music games following, although, like, the Beimani games are still doing plenty of original music. There's also plenty of licensed music interspersed in them. I think that the general audience doesn't have a lot of appetite for music games, at least in the English-speaking audience. The general audience doesn't have a lot of appetite for music games with original songs, as much as those are nice. The other thing I'm going to say, this has nothing to do with anything other than that I occasionally need to remind potential new listeners that it exists. Sony Japan's incredible Train a Polar Bear to be an Enka Singer game, Kuma Uta, for the PS2. Everyone go look up some videos of Kuma Uta.
Mm-hmm.
For those not versed in Japanese, that just means bear song. But yeah, genuinely deranged. If you've ever wanted to listen to a polar bear sing in an extremely, like, fucking obviously, like, synthesized voice, it sounds a bit like Stephen Hawking, but in Japanese, and with some auto-tune filtering on it, while, like, floating in front of a, like, surrealistic background, standing on a stage that mostly resembles, like, a coin-operated laundromat. That game has you covered. But yeah, I fucking love Kamuta, and I will reference it anytime I get the chance. I do want to briefly mention, like, most of these aren't questions, but we did get a bunch of comments from Slime Hunter, and I don't want them to go uncommented upon. On our last episode, Slime Hunter said, more like Decadive Capcom, hopefully the new RPG Mega Man will be okay and not marred by the VA decision. For those unaware, like, Capcom went non-union with Mega Man Dual Override. What I would say is that they're mostly doing this because they got away with doing it for basically all of their other games, so this was kind of an inevitability.
Mm.
Like, Resident Evil went non-union in 2019, and I think most of their franchises have been slowly moving in that direction since, so not that surprising. A shame, but not surprising. Not an RPG, but I think I guess there have been Mega Man RPGs in the series. I just hope they continue doing well by the fans and devs. They seem to be in a good position for that. I'm not too concerned. Still holding out hope for a new Breath of Fire someday. I mean, yes. Never say never given the role that they're on.
I mean, we just got X Tetra in English, apparently, so nothing is off the table at this point.
Yeah, apparently. I just feel like Monster Hunter Stories has kind of fit that niche in their catalog.
Certainly. We might see at least, like, a nice Breath of Fire Legacy Collection or something at some point.
I mean, Breath of Fire 4 also just came out on Steam, like, last month.
It's random.
They've been putting all the stuff that had been on GOG has been moved to Steam as well.
Okay.
Capcom really likes using Steam as, like, a what if our legacy titles just generated money forever? And I mean, I can't blame them on that one. Also, heck yeah, PS3 games. I want my little boy back. Super relatable. But for me, it was the original PS3, not Slim, but feels special. Evercade releases do seem kind of weird these days, especially with dual analog stick release and new hardware models that are going to probably split the audience. What you said about really being committed to the platform makes sense. I had no idea they were putting out mobile releases of Docomo games. That's super hyper specific and definitely interesting doing that. Let's see. I feel like emulators are becoming more viable for PS2 than PS2/PS3 games on PS4, 5, 6 now. Not advocating for downloading a car, but it's getting not so great, so I feel like spending that around 6 months learning RetroArch worth it now. Yeah, I mean, like, get used to learning to emulate if you want to play anything that isn't going to, that has any complications about who owns it or any question about whether it could make money coming back. But yeah, just wanted to catch those so that we didn't forget them. Okay.
And yes, please comment again in the future. We appreciate all commenters.
Yes, we love all commenters. Questions or no. Okay. Isn't it strange that there aren't that many parody rapper biopics besides CB4 and Fear of a Black Hat? I have never heard of either of those. Both those films were about early 90s gangster rap. You would think that hip-hop having replaced rock as the default music, there would have been a lot more parody rapper biopics. It's one of those things, like, I think that the kind of people that have like decision-making power on this kind of thing also are some combination of dismissive of and or leery about their capacity to make good jokes about this subject. So you just end up with this just ends up not happening. It's a hyper specific subgenre. So it's one of those things, like, I'm trying to think of I'm thinking of, like, you know, Yeah, I can't think of anything else that really touches or approaches this, but I think that there's like a lot of headwinds that keep that kind of thing from happening. Marvin Gaye sabotaged one of his albums so the royalties wouldn't go into the alimony for his wife. I wonder if we've seen or will see a similar case with game developers sabotaging their products to get out of contractual obligations. That can really only work if you're contracted for multiple things up front, and game devs are basically never are.
Yeah. Plus, in the case of Marvin Gaye, there was a singular point of control there, whereas games tend to be much more group effort, I guess.
You will just get fired. I assume the album, like, I'm not like the most up to date on Marvin Gaye, but I assume the album he's talking about is Here My Dear, which is a famously viciously unpleasant album, where he got his wife divorced him, sought child support for their adopted son. Warrant was issued for his arrest after he failed to pay alimony. So yeah, I believe the title is meant to be like essentially a spit of venom, like, you know, there, I wrote something that'll get you money, here, my dear, kind of thing. But yeah. It's one of those things that, like, essentially the only people that could theoretically do this would be like an extremely high clout indie developer who probably, like, the other thing you run into is that, like, when publishing agreements are signed for games, there's usually a pretty specific thing that they're signing for the delivery of. Whereas, yep, like, music contracts are usually like, you will deliver us this many albums of new material, this many albums of, like, compiled or live material, like, but there's very little you can do about, like, the contract is typically not written in such a way that it's like, well, it has to be, you know, there's only so much that you can do to write a contract for songs not yet written about what their genre has to be.
Well, I've heard some fun stories about Weird Al Yankovic doing stuff with his contract. Like Rhino Records learned to regret demanding that he do a Christmas song.
That probably is. I'm either The Night Santa Went Crazy or Christmas at Ground Zero. I think they probably
it was Christmas
both.
At Ground Zero specifically the first time.
Yeah, I remember finding out that the reason a lot of bands end up putting out live albums and greatest hits albums and is just part of the contractual obligation. And then I still have an old issue of Guitar World magazine from, I don't know, 2001. And I always hung on to it because my bass instructor had given it to me and there was some cool tabs and riffs in there. But basically on the cover, you have Dave Mustaine like sitting in an electric chair, and it was there. I think one of the last albums he put out with Capitol Records was Capitol Punishment. So,
went for it.
Yeah, he really did.
So what I will say is that this probably won't happen in the future, but it has happened in the past. Back when games were much smaller to develop. There's a few infamous ones that occurred in the British PC space, most notably one called Squidge. That's spelled S-Q-I-J. And it's a pretty infamous game. So Squidge, by all knowledge that we've been able to obtain about its creation, it seems to have been produced by, like, some British bedroom coder. I think he was, like, 16 at the time. He'd signed a contract that said he had to make games for, was this publisher called like the Powerhouse or something? Yes, the Powerhouse.
You can read a lot more about this on like badgamehalloffame.com. But basically, the short version is that like he wasn't happy with the contract. He wanted out. He had to give them another game. He gave them Squidge, a game that was designed to be essentially unreleasable.
And then they released it.
Yeah, of course they released it. They didn't give a shit. They didn't even look at it. They just slapped it on a cassette tape along with like three other games. But like Squidge was unplayable as designed. If you played it, if you tried to play it normally, the controls did not work. But did not work, I mean, it would not read any inputs because it was designed to look for lowercase inputs on the ZX Spectrum keyboard. And one of the first things that the game does is do a memory poke that forces the game into caps lock. So
no
will ever work. No. If you, do a memory poke to undo the caps lock, you can move around. It's very slow and it doesn't work very well, but you can. But if you actually make it to any of the doors of the first room you start in, the game crashes. And just for fun, there's no data outside the. There's no additional data outside those like doors. Like there's nothing for them to connect to, in the data. Like it's not like there are other rooms hidden in the data. It's just like that's all there is. And most of the program is taken up with a pirated copy of like a different program. So Squidge is probably the closest thing to what you're thinking of someone just being like, "Fuck this, I'm out." I know there are other examples. Like, if you want other examples of this, the British and certain parts of Europe PC industry of the mid 80s is full of this shit because, like, games could be made by one or at most two people, and software houses would, like, accept submissions from just random people mailing them shit. So you would end up with like very strange low rent companies giving contracts to people who were oftentimes literal children. And that produces a lot of people being like, I am absolutely sick of working on this and don't care about it. I just want them to stop asking me for a program. So get a few of those. And yeah, like that's where you'll get stories of this in game dev, but like modern game dev, there's basically like there's actual contracts that are signed before money changes hands, and those contracts tend to have delivery of like we are contracting a development studio to make a specific game and we'll sue them into oblivion if like that we have rights of refusal on like whether we think it's not good enough, and like we will sue them into oblivion if the game is not, if you fail to complete the project. But yeah, so it's just a fascinating thing that happens as the inevitability of people just hating contracts with all their lives.
I feel that. Yeah.
Okay. Last week you talked a lot about fighting games and visual novels remaining niche, but what about immersive sims? The joke is that no matter how good of a studio you are, you make an immersive sim and you're going to go bankrupt. For all the people that complain about open world games feeling empty, there's a level of interaction high enough to scare them. Is this problem of immersive sims don't hold hands for long enough? So there's a few problems, not the least of which is that no one can agree what counts as an immersive sim. There's a bunch of things that people can point at and say, like, because they're originators of this like loose, I'd hesitate to even call it a genre, I would call it like design concept. Because like a design philosophy, like no one can seem to agree on what counts other than like beyond the definitive originators like System Shock 2, the Thief games, and those two, that
pair of Deus Ex, like that set of games, like sets a number of things that are kind of related, but like most people would look at those and say that they aren't the same genre, which is why I wouldn't describe this as a genre. I would describe it more as a design philosophy. The other thing is that you'll also note that while at the time several of those were at least somewhat commercially successful, none of them were world beaters, because the thing that people like about immersive sims tends to be things that only come through when you play them a lot, obsessively, and you start to understand elements of how their systems interlock. And frankly, while you will find games that have those kinds of interlocking systems that reward replay on various platforms, you will find games that do that at various points, that become popular. It's rarely the reason those things become popular. There's just a lot of issues with the fact that the things that make immersive sims sticky to people who love them to also be things that require you to obsessively play one game many times. Let's see. But yeah. So I would ultimately say that the other thing is that the immersive and the is that cross world games are typically marketed around a breadth of scope, mm-hmm. and exploring a vast area, whereas the things that make immersive sim games that tend to get tagged as immersive sims, things that tend to make them interesting are small and intimate spaces that have a lot of reactivity. So while both are theoretically about player freedom, they do not actually collide in terms of how they function. But yeah, it's just kind of... and the other thing is that they are, even if you are aiming to please immersive sim fans, they're those people can't agree beyond the first handful what counts. What still counts as an immersive sim is is the biggest part of any immersive sim discussion, and tons of things that look like they probably are meant to count get tossed off because no one can agree what this is, because it's not really a genre. It's just a idea around making these very systematized games that still have strong narrative cores, and how you can give the player a number of tools to get through to the next piece of narrative instead of giving them a specifically designed route. And maybe some of the way you give them a lot of tools is by giving them several designed routes, but allowing systems to collide with each other in ways that are important. But again, those are all of these terms I just said are extremely gummy. They're hard to pin down as to what is or what isn't. Even though all genres are at least a little loose and hard to define, mm-hmm. You can usually get a base principle, something that makes it immediately obvious that something at least has elements of something. And immersive sims is just I wouldn't even know where to start. because it's such a nebulous concept. I would honestly probably argue that
And, you know, you can't get people to agree from base principles. Does an immersive sim make? Yes, a number of the early ones are, but, like, those generally, like, not terribly related to the things people talk about as being, like, core to the immersive sim experience, other than the fact that a bunch of those early ones are in fact first person. So some people do consider that to be necessary, but there's, like, the, you know, you can make plenty of first person action RPGs that would not be considered that. Like, very few people would argue that The Elder Scrolls is an immersive sim, even though it shares a lot of aesthetic similarities with some of those other ones. Like, you know, you'll get something like Morrowind, and you'll sometimes see people allow that in, but not really. It doesn't really play like any of those others. Like, it does have multiple solutions, but they're not typically super emergent. Like, it's... You know, these are the issues you run into. This is one of the most nebulous genres imaginable, if we call it a genre. So, yeah, I think the issue you've run into is that, like, a lot of the kinds of person that would like this more of these would actually be one of the people most resistant to accepting a new one. So that's where we're at. Okay. I've asked several times about people using the most optimized, easiest to execute, most repetitive method of playing in fighting games, RPGs, etc. Is there anything more fun when the participants are bad at it? For example, when MMA became a thing in the 90s, you got karateka, judoka, boxers, etc., who had absolutely no idea what they were doing in the ring, just slugging it out. It was hilarious. Then people figured it out that you should just practice Muay Thai and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Yeah, like, there are definitely, like, I think certain kinds of, like, shallow action games are more fun when you don't know how to play them, because you haven't figured out that, like what their limits are. I think that can be true for a lot of games that have systems that have some depth, but not necessarily a lot, where, like, when you don't know how to play them, it's like, oh, this feels like there's a lot to it. And then, like, once you've drilled down into everything that's in it, it ceases to be interesting. I think that's actually one of the things that becomes exhausting about, like, a lot of the trend towards, like, pick from three things, upgrade trees in games. It's not that pick from three things is bad. Like, obviously, plenty of games do that well. But, like, the decision tree is actually quite shallow, and, like, the difference between any of the three things is simply not that much. But, yeah, I do have I do have a fondness for 90s MMA, even though it's full of nightmares. But just because, like, you could watch an MMA card that had, like, eight people in it, and half of them would be representing styles that didn't actually exist. there was absolutely a... God, what was his... Let me make sure that I'm remembering this man correctly. Yeah. Okay. So there was absolutely a one-time UFC welterweight champion, a Canadian man named Carlos Newton, who represented what he dubbed Dragon Ball Jiu-Jitsu. And mostly what that meant is that he would, like, do some combination of, like, wrestling, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and Judo at you. But then he would, like, make weird Kamehameha motions after he threw you around a bit. Kind of owns. Love it. Nothing but love in my heart for Carlos Newton. But there's a lot of, like, weirdness in that, where, like, someone would... me see. I'm trying to remember some of these because, like, I have some friends that have, like, think about what my knowledge is of obscure video games, and they have that, but for, like, 90s MMA.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, like, there's some really wild, like, fake fighting styles being listed, and that's also back when, like, someone enters MMA because, like, they're a bouncer at a bar and someone told them that they looked pretty tough and they won an arm wrestling tournament or whatever. it was a time. Let's see. What's the deal with gritty adult humor Muppet parodies, like Puppets Who, I don't know what just got censored there.
You mean Wondershosen?
I don't know. Or Meet the Feebles. Is this just a case of the joke writes itself on the neon sign? So obvious that people just get it right away. I mean, original Muppets, like the original Muppets pilot is called Sex and Violence.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I think it's just down to, like, you know, it's an easy thing to do.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like asking about, like, the mascot subgenre of horror, where it's basically take this cute thing that people loved as kids and find a way of turning it into a Lovecraftian horror story.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but
I mean, yeah. Is it,
like, I think...
Yeah, okay, yeah, sorry.
Oh, I'm just saying, like, yeah, I think that, like, the general way of, like, this is just that, like, even more than cartoons, like, other than the Muppet Show, is, like, the most child-coded activity in, like, American society. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a ton of work for something that, like, you know, most people do not have any time or respect for, so you end up with, like, well, only a child would watch this. And so, like, well, what if we made that for sex perverts is an easy, quote unquote, option for, like, an idea. And, like, even the Henson Shop is not 100% free of this.
Did you ever watch Being John Malkovich?
I did not, but I know about it.
The main character in this is an aspiring puppeteer, but he's not a children's puppeteer. He is artistic. He also gets beaten up once because some guy let his daughter watch it because he thought it was going to be a kid's thing, and it was not a kid's thing.
Oh, no.
It was nothing explicit, but at the same time, it was very much, it was like based on a medieval romance, actually, like the love letters of this monk and this nun. And it's just, that's the first thing I thought of, is like, this is very much not the kind of show that he's talking about, but at the same time, it kind of is, because there's the it was based on the expectation that puppet shows must be for kids, and this was not for kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, watch Being John Malkovich. It is just a bizarre, but very entertaining movie. Yes.
It's wild.
Yeah,
it's wild.
And for that matter, just for something shorter and also really ridiculous, again, I must recommend Resident Evil 8's puppet show commercials.
Those are fun.
You've seen those, right?
Yes.
It's just imagine me walking into a video game store about 5-6 years ago, not realizing that what was playing on the TV at the time, and going, what the hell? And again, it's even funnier if like me, you've actually seen a lot of Japanese morning television and some of the puppet shows that they have for kids. And you can start spotting the references in this... And this Resident Evil parody. It's like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
No worries.
Memory there.
We've already talked about how modern Final Fantasy and Kingdom Hearts upgrades allow iconic weapons like the Buster Sword and Kingdom Key to stay relevant longer. The question is, why doesn't Square Enix feature the Ultima weapon and other Ultimate weapons more prominently in marketing?
You'd think that showing the best version of the character with the best weapon are both A, visually striking, and B, stimulating players to stick with the game. I think it's ultimately, like, usually, like, they'll give the character an iconic weapon. They like doing that. But at the same time, they don't want it to be, like, they want it to be something that you're going to have for large portions of the game because, you know, like, an endgame weapon you're not going to have for that long, relatively speaking. And the other thing is that they like that to be a surprise, or even sometimes for that to be ambiguous, like, what is the best weapon? And a lot of the time the answer is up for debate.
+1
Like, or, you know, sometimes, you know, deeply hidden for reasons that don't always make a ton of sense. But yeah, like, I think that it's ultimately, like, it is funny that, like, sometimes the iconic weapon ends up being something weird. My, like, the one I'm thinking of is, like, the Brotherhood in FF10 is a mid-game weapon. Like, it is neither the first thing that Tidus has, nor is it the last thing that he gets. It's just, like...
It does get an upgrade at one point.
It does get an upgrade, and that means that it's probably useful for longest, but that's also in part because FF10 weapons don't do that much for most of the game.
Yeah.
They're very situational, and the amount of upgrades they can actually confer are pretty limited. But, yeah, like, I think it's down to... You want to make sure that it, like, it's something that you don't mind plastering all over marketing, that you don't care about spoiling. And a first weapon is usually easier for that than the last one, especially because it's going to be a piece of their characterization. Like, giving Cloud the big-ass sword, the Buster sword at the start, like, is characterizing the kind of blunt character that he is at the start.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I mean, honestly, the Brotherhood in Final Fantasy X is probably the best-looking sword in the game.
So, oh, it's definitely its best design, and it fits the game's entire water aesthetic, which is probably another reason that it got pride of place.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Speaking of the Ultima weapon, do you think that the name is chosen because it fits with any weapon that is just strongest in the game, or isn't just like Excalibur or Calibolg, which are just have to be swords? And again, most Ultima weapons are swords. Yes, but not all of them. And yeah, I think that it was chosen entirely because it was just a name that you could give that didn't have terrible amounts of specificity about what it was.
I mean, at least one game was also a boss. So.
Mm-hmm. I think it is in a couple, actually. But yeah.
I just remember Atma weapon, which was a interesting Woolseyism there, but was supposed to be Ultima weapon.
Yeah, I think he was just trying to get it into a smaller character limit, but yeah. What was I going to say? But yeah, like 6 and 7, it's both like an enemy that you kill that drops it, and it doesn't have a terribly specific design. It's actually interesting that it's like they're more consistent about how it functions. But because there's a few games where like the Ultima weapon functions as like with the same like weird gimmick it has in FF7, where it's stronger the more health you have.
I mean, it started with Final Fantasy VI.
Yeah, like, and that continues in a few things. Like Calibolg is not called Ultima weapon, but it still has that gimmick.
Yeah, and well, Final Fantasy 13, for each character, any one of their weapons can be turned into the Ultima weapon, which I thought was interesting. But I think it would still retain some of those qualities. Like Lightning has a sword that I think just gives her an extra bar to her, you know, gauge. So it's like, oh, well, gee, that's the one I use, so that's the one I'll turn into the Ultima weapon. But that game also had a very weird upgrading system, and yeah, I don't know.
Kind of weird game. Grindy upgrading system. Let's see, this one Gaijin might have something, and I would imagine that the answer to this has to be yeah, probably at least a few, but Fireminer asking, is there any novel or game that makes you read kanji in the normal ways at first but then suddenly requires you to read them in proper like Chinese or other languages transliterated into like kanji characters. Also, how easy is it?
Okay, so you mean like manyogana? Okay, so first of all, in a Japanese novel, if you're going to be messing around with kanji, you're probably going to be using the furigana notation on the side to give an extra meaning to it. So that's how, like, for example, Gundam can have kanji.
Mm-hmm. Lots of anime will do that.
Yeah, because the kanji are not actually pronounced Gundam, except that Gundam is written over them. Things like that. And you'll find that in a lot of series. I mean, Gundam does it all the time. Full Metal Alchemist did it with a lot of stuff. The Dragon Quest manga will have the name of the spell written out in kanji, but will also have the game name of it written in katakana right next to it. Things like that. Now, if you're talking about using the kanji to read it phonetically or something, that's manyogamana, and nobody does that anymore. There's a good reason why nobody does that anymore. There's a good reason why Japanese invented two separate phonetic writing systems so that they could avoid doing it like this.
Yeah, that sounds nightmarish. But I think he's more just asking about suddenly requiring like Chinese readings. But I feel like in order to do that, you would have to assume that the reader would have some familiarity with what those are, which might be dovetailing with his other question of how easy is it for Japanese people to learn Chinese or Korean?
Well, I mean, aside from the fact that they're in three quite different language families. Let's see. Okay, so the biggest issue with learning Chinese starting from Japanese is that Japanese has literally somewhere between 1/10 and 1/20 of the number of kanji that Chinese does. But a lot, all the symbols for Japanese have, at least one secondary reading that is theoretically derived from a dialect of Chinese, except that this dialect may have been current 1,000 years ago and not necessarily directly related to any version of Chinese currently spoken.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, you can draw some similarities here and there. Like the symbol for C is pronounced, has the secondary reading Kai in Japanese, but it's the Hai in Shanghai as well.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that.
I do think that like, oh, sorry.
Oh yeah. But the only kanji that would need to be read as Chinese in a Japanese, any sort of media would have to be classical Chinese names, in which case they're probably using Japanese versions of the pronunciations to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
It really doesn't
pretty dissimilar.
Anything that would actually require a separate or different pronunciation, including things like that one kid's name from Cardcaptor Sakura, they would have the pronunciation written along the side for it.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah.
But yeah, like, I think I had some amateur hour thing I was going to say, but I've totally spaced on it, so it's just fine. Let's see. When Andor just finished its course, I asked about the idea that if you were not knowledgeable or articulated enough about difficult subjects like politics, you should just avoid them. I watched Project Hail Mary. The author of the original novel sure seems like the kind of guy who's only interested in cool science, people doing cool things, and disregards stuff like psychoanalysis or political feasibility of the whole endeavor. And anywhere has gone on record talking about his distaste about social and political commentary in science fiction. Is there any writer, movie, or game director that you just have to tell yourself this guy's only interested in this one thing before enjoying their works? Not even talking about the kind of artists who plainly say there's nothing political in that. Like, what we end up running into is that people have differing definitions of what counts as political content. Like, many people if you're making the argument, like, that there's no such thing as a non-political piece of art, you're working from the subject that, like, from a different lens than someone who says that, like, my
work is not political, because oftentimes what that person means, like when someone says there's no such thing as a non-political piece of art, they're actually arguing that like all thematics carry political weight, that you can't like make a piece of art that expresses a theme without that theme being like analyzable in a political lens. Whereas usually when someone says there's no politics in my work, what they're actually saying is I did not intend any real world politics, even though I'm like threading in some kind of like personal thematic like belief. We start with that base level like assumption that these two people are taught this debate involves some degree of people talking past each other because they have differing ideas of what is political and what is just a theme.
And unfortunately, there's also the third strain of people for whom politics means certain types of people exist.
Yes, and those people are using are using the "my works are not political" thing as cover to spread horrible.
They're politics.
Yeah. Right. Yes, they are. You know, because they are using that idea of like, well, I'm not making specific political statements to spread politics of, yes, this is just the baseline. This is just reality.
And part of the current thing with Andy Weir is that he's probably in group two where he's not really thinking about the context or anything, but he was making these comments on a podcast that is very definitely part of group three.
Right.
Yeah.
Not ideal.
Yeah. And then making comments of this nature about the original Star Trek, which was very much aware of its politics.
You did not put people of that many races and cultures in one American TV show in the 1960s without having an idea of what you had done.
I mean, when the primary reason Nichelle Nichols continued with the show through to the end was because Martin Luther King Jr. told her how much his family appreciated seeing her on TV.
The reason that people like dead authors is that dead authors can't tell them that they're wrong anymore. Offering the most amount of cover for people who are merely stupid, or that's me being glib, but people who are merely like unwilling to consider the extra dimensions of their work. There are some people who genuinely think, well, I'm not like endorsing a political party. And it's like, yes, but that is not what your work is inherently political means. It's simply like, if I were to try to analyze the average RPG, I would say that it is mostly like status quo reifying, and that it has like that there are, you know, inherent to any like if we look at a fantasy story, there's inherent to anything that has you trying to say restore peace to the kingdom, and like it there is essentially functionally a monarchist view of society. Ultimately we could, you know, I can try to read, say, Dragon Quest through that lens, and I would find that that's mostly unsatisfying because, frankly, it is not a work of terribly coherent politics when read that way. And ultimately, what you have to read out of it ends up being more like how it defines people and characters rather than how it defines its world. But, you know, like, there is no joy in analyzing things in a purely, like, to me, at least, there's no joy in analyzing narrative as pure thought experiment puzzle box. I am reading a story about people and worlds. I am not contemplating Maxwell's Demon.
Unless Maxwell's Demon is a character in the book, which was the case for several series in the 90s, because they really liked to do that.
It does happen sometimes.
No, I mean, yeah, I think in the author sphere, or just in the very small social community of late 80s, early 90s science fiction fantasy authors, Maxwell's Demon was one of the things that got referenced a lot, and so it actually became a character in multiple books by multiple different authors that I know of. Either
either just a random appearance or an actual character.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the things. If you go back to like the 70s, you start seeing a lot of references to the genie of the three wishes from the Arabian Nights, not the Aladdin version, but the one where you find the bottle in the beach and you open it up, and basically the genie has vowed that if anyone wakes him up after this amount of time, they get three wishes. But with the longer the time lasts between him getting out, it decreases the number of wishes until he just decides to kill everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That one shows up in a strange number of books as well, and it's kind of crazy. Okay, sorry, my digression.
No worries.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Just a quick one, and I think I'm starting to mentally shut down, so we're probably going to shut down after this one. Okay. A few years ago, I brought up the topic of Chuck Norris's phoned-in performances in Crime Boss, Rocky City. The thing with all those Chuck Norris memes is that if you had watched the films where he starred as the protagonist, he just didn't look credible at all. Man had less charisma and presence than Van Damme, and Van Damme was a far cry from Stallone or Gibson. But somewhere along the way, the internet just started to think Chuck Norris was a genuine badass. So that leads us to the question, can information only become a meme when it either A, is a useful shorthand, or B, is funny? It isn't funny to watch Chuck Norris's films, or just three episodes of Walker, Texas Ranger, to realize that he sucked. It's more fun to pretend that he's badass. So, like, I think another, like, big thing about this was that, like, everyone knew that Chuck Norris was in action films, but no one would bother to watch those. But, like, or more broadly, how to put this, like, the initial joke was that pretending that he was really cool was funny. Like that is the a lot of those memes about, like, people tend to be your face sticks that way if you make it too long. You can only do something ironically for so long. So, like, pretending that Chuck Norris was really cool, the joke was, if you've ever seen anything he's ever been in, he is at best the least interesting thing about it. Like, you know, there's, like, he's in a Bruce Lee movie, as I recall, and he just gets his ass beat, and, like, yeah, the fun part is watching Bruce Lee beat his ass. But, you know, in general, like, that was the joke. Originally, a lot of those jokes were, like, you know, a lot of those jokes were a stock kind of joke that you made around something that was campy or kitsch. A lot of Chuck Norris jokes were essentially recycled from the internet, making essentially the same jokes about Mr. T, a guy who had an extremely, like, camp appeal because he was like cool, but he was also, yeah, like, also just that he was always over the top. And, you know, they snapped on to Chuck Norris fairly easily because it was like, well, this guy's ridiculous. And it didn't and, like, you had the extra joke that if you'd ever seen him in anything, it was like, well, that sucked. And so it was funny to pretend that you thought he was really cool. And then, of course, like, immediately the response from a lot of people who hadn't ever actually seen him in anything was, yeah, cool. It's funny to say things about how this guy is cool. And eventually, like, that just leaves the realm of joke. It's just a, like, signifier. It has left meaning behind. It is the shape of a joke without the substance. And that's kind of what memes end up turning into. And you see that all the time. Like, subcultures develop memes that are, like, theoretically start as jokes and eventually just turn into a signifier that shows that you are aware of the subculture. They no longer mean anything, and, like, oftentimes, like, people descend into civil war over them. But, yeah, like, that's kind of how these things end up going. And I think, ultimately, like, they kind of do have to start as funny in order to be memorable, because otherwise it's just someone saying something. Like, you know, way back in the day, like, Channers had the turned for Milhouse is not a meme into a meme to reference the idea that someone was trying to make something a meme that simply wasn't fun. And, like, that, you know, like, to some extent that continues to dog
humanity as a concept. Like, you, like, the thing that causes something to spread is usually it brings some sort of positive emotion or some, like, negative emotions tend to be, like, they'll spread something temporarily. Positive emotions will spread something for over longer periods of time. Funny is a very, like, short-term positive emotion. And so you put all of those together, you get these kinds of, like, you know, thing starts as funny, and then, like, people keep saying it because they remember it being funny. They remember it being funny, even if they don't fully understand why it was funny. Like, the shell of the joke survives longer than its contents.
The fossil of the joke.
I am not qualified to be making statements like this. I apologize. I want to quickly shout out to both Fire Miner and Slime Hunter for your comments and questions this week. And I want to thank you both by letting you hear about good reading material you could be engaging with.
Well, good news is that I am almost in possession of the final cover art I need for this series.
Damn. End of an era.
At which point episodes 14 and 15 of Princesses of the Pizza Parlor will be seeing a double release, just so I can get it out there. And so that would be the 15 episodes, 5 side stories, 1 novel, so 21 ebooks, or hopefully soon to be 6 paperbacks worth of material. Need to figure out the exact word count here, but I'm pretty sure I have surpassed War and Peace by a few thousand at this point.
And that's all that really mattered.
Yeah. So, in accordance with the meta joke I made about the series itself back in episode 12, 11. So, Princesses of the Pizza Parlor for Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. If you enjoy tabletop role-playing games or people playing tabletop role-playing games, not necessarily yourself, because honestly, sometimes we have to wonder who has the time or the readily available friend group to make this work. I mean, podcasts are difficult enough to manage some years, apparently. So, Princesses of the Pizza Parlor by Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu, for Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. Among other things, so let's get to the other things. We have Vainglorious Long as the Night, lit RPG, Metroidvania with B-movie aesthetics. Just me trying out new stuff here. Then Tanuki as a Teapot, Japanese Folk Tales, all about Japan, animals. Just some of them very obscure, some of them not so obscure, but all fun. And continuing on, under the other pen name, Michael Spearwater, we have A Wager for Wanderlust, which is not young adult fantasy. Let's leave it at that. Just, again, me experimenting with different types of stories, different genres, and that one's mostly out there just to be out there. If anyone enjoys reading it, I would love to hear what you think. At this point, I am under no expectations of ever making a living off of this. I just want to have the stories out there.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's respectable.
Yep. In about a week and a half, I should have the next one out called The Sin of Tantalus, which I'm really having trouble finding a good way of describing this because... So, Dave, do you know the concept of the cozy catastrophe subgenre?
I can think of things that probably would count as those words, but I'm not sure if I know the exact subgenre itself.
Well, it was originally the term was originally coined as kind of an insult to a certain subset of the British science fiction writing community.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, Day of the Triffids was. That was the first one called that. But basically, an idea where you have some sort of catastrophe or social collapse or some other big problem going on, but
day-to-day life for most people doesn't change that much, aside mm-hmm. from the constant threat of death occasionally. Yep, so basically, so the Sin of Tantalus is me taking a bunch of zombie tropes, even though I absolutely detest actual contagion horror media for the most part. Which is, again, why my only contact with Resident Evil is through discussing storylines with you guys. taking this and applying it to, I'm guessing, near future social distancing dystopia is going to be the best thing here. Life is generally okay for most people who are not the protagonist or his friends.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, it's like they're on the menu.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the problem there. Anyway, that should be available May 8th. It's currently open for pre-order. I think a few people actually have. I don't know how or why.
I've been referencing it every time you've been gone, like as though it were out, because I'm a fucking idiot who misremembered that it wasn't out yet.
No worries. I mean, you can find it on Amazon easy enough. So,
mm-hmm.
yep. And then later, in like maybe 2 months or so, I should have another one coming out called Monsters Among Us, Teenage Wasteland, which this one has a longer and much more fraught attempt at a publishing history that I should go into at a different date. Suffice to say, this one is getting published largely to spite someone else. I mean, also because I want everyone to read the story, but the current circumstances of its publication is spite.
Okay.
Yeah, wow. I think possibly many years ago you may have actually referenced this obliquely on a podcast, so.
Yeah. Sometime in the past 2 years or so, yes. I will go into this more at a later date, preferably after this book is already out. Maybe,
but suffice to say, help us prove someone wrong.
Yes. And so, yes, this is officially my year of getting things finished. So let's say, okay, finished up. Got the Sin of Tantalus coming out. Got Monsters Among Us coming out. Finished up Princesses of the Pizza Parlor. Now working on this mermaid epic that I've been literally. I've gone through many, many different revisions over the past 15, 16 years at this point. And it's almost done, for real. Yay. Should be like 300,000 words when it's done. 4 books. I will have more things coming in the future. Many, many more. Yeah. The mermaid story you can find on Royal Road under Michael Yadimizu. Title is Merimanoa, M-E-R space M-A-N-O-A. Just updating sections of it every Saturday or so. Next update should put it at 200,000 words on there over the past year.
Dang.
Yeah. Like I said, I mean, this is partially in order to spur me on to actually finish it this spring. So I've been updating it slowly ever since last March of 2025. Okay. Yeah. Books.
Yeah. Read a book. It'll be good for your soul.
Yes, please read books. So where is the stupid sound? Oops, that's not the right.
Buy my book.
Yeah, let me just pull this up for you.
Soundboard, there we go. There we go.
Buy my book!
Oh, okay. That's what happens when more than one person hits at the same time. Okay.
Nerd!
Joe, where can we find you?
Okay, so I'm still doing live streams for RP Gamer. So you're probably watching that channel right now. So twitch.tv/rpgamer. So Tuesday and Thursday nights, 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Eastern time. I'm still streaming East 10 Proud Nordics. I'd mentioned it before, and I think I'm getting close to the end. The PS5 is telling me that I'm like 86% done with the game or something like that. I'm sure there's other side content and whatnot, but I'll probably move on to something else once I clear the... Yeah, so PlayStation's telling me 83% done after 26 hours of play. So, yeah, and that's on the shorter end of JRPGs, to be sure. So, I do enjoy the game, and I want to see how it ends. I like where the story's going. So, yeah, so tune into that, please. And, of course, I'm here every week on Q&A Quest, and we do shenanigans on Sunday nights. We play whatever games we feel like, and that usually starts around midnight on the Ask Wheels channel. You can also check out my YouTube channel under Smoke and Joe Gamer. Every year I do something called Metroidvania, where I play Metroidvanias during May. So since I stream RPGs for RP Gamer, I'll probably just end up doing some new YouTube videos of various Metroidvanias. So every year I just try to find new ones that I haven't covered yet. And I try to balance it between new ones that I haven't played, but also some of my favorites. And sometimes I may just throw like an Axiom Verge randomizer or Bloodstained Ritual of the Night randomizer in there somewhere. I was actually going through some games to see, gee, what haven't I covered in previous years? And I'm looking at Iconoclasts. So that's a neat one. And
nice.
Yeah, I'm trying to bring up my list, and of course now the PS5 wants to be stupid. So I was looking at that. I think Jedi Survivor would count. I don't know if I streamed that before. I might go back and do like Salt and Sanctuary. It's been a long time since I played that one. Yeah, and I always look for any Castlevania games that I either haven't played or haven't covered or both. So I think I was actually playing Castlevania Chronicles for the PS1 for the first time. It's like, oh, maybe I could stream that or do a video on it. I never played...
But it's pretty neat.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I would also just count any Metroid or Castlevania game. I don't know. But whatever. You know what? I make up the rules as I go. It's fine. I never played Guacamelee before. That looks neat. I got that through PlayStation Plus at some point. Just on the lookout for anything. But if you check, you know, past years, you go through my 500 YouTube videos, you'll find, you know, plenty of videos from previous years where I maybe did like Super Metroid or Metroid Fusion, Metroid Prime, that sort of thing. So consider liking, subscribing, whatever is contextual. And you can follow me on Blue Sky under Smoke and Joe Gamer. I might also try Tesla Grad for the first time. That looked like a neat game. So that's it. Yeah. So follow me on various platforms if you'd like.
It's a good time. Let's see. And that just leaves me in Wheels, the podcast as a whole. Actually, it's the podcast as a whole. Fuck this. You don't want to hear from me more. You already heard like an hour of me just rambling while people try to get a word in edgewise. You can ask us questions or leave comments. We typically record. We were a little later than usual this evening, which is why I kind of tried to cut it off a little early, but... you can leave comments for us when we record by catching twitch.tv/rpgamer or twitch.tv/askwheels on Monday nights in the US at usually somewhere between 8 and 9 Pacific until one or all of us is too tired to continue. So in that 8 to 9 p.m., 11 to 12 p.m., 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific, 11 to 12 p.m. Eastern start time. You can also ask us questions by going to the RP Gamer Discord, which you can join by going to the community tab on RP Gamer. If you ask us questions or leave comments in the podcast sections, we're always happy to hear it. Or you can leave comments under this very episode on RP Gamer, as our friend Slime Hunter did today. So thank you to both Slime Hunter and Fire Miner for giving us fodder for the discussion. And what was I going to say? We also have our sister show Shenanigans, where we just sort of play whatever at 9 p.m. East Pacific, midnight Eastern on Sundays. Always a good time. Always, always a good excuse to chat and play whatever. Sometimes multiplayer, sometimes not. I'm the antisocial one, so if two people are fighting each other, it's usually Wheels and Joe. But by fighting each other, I mean playing a co-op game together in a way that seems adversarial.
We do that.
It does happen. But otherwise, I think that about wraps it up for us. So see you, Space Cowboys.
See you. Yeah, when this we played Marvel Rivals, we were supposed to be on the same team.
Good mole man to you.
It was usually just me getting mad because we kept losing. Oh, boy.
I need some new sounds in the soundboard.
Yeah.
This is just so...
Oh, man.
This is... What?
This is boring.
All right, let's mole man out of here.
This is Mole Man in the morning. Good Mole Man to you.
Mole Man gets to stay no matter what.